With Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 44th episode of Robots. Today's show is centered around robots in the air, and more specifically on unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs. We'll be speaking with Joshua Portlock from Cyber Technology from Australia about their portfolio of different sized UAVs, with special emphasis on the CyberQuad, our four-rotor helicopter with advanced autonomous capabilities.
Towards the end of the show, we'll also be launching our big debate on what exactly is the definition of a robot, so make sure you stick around. Before, let's get started with the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Following our announcement of the 6th anniversary of NASA's Spirit and Opportunity Mars robots in the last episode, NASA has now had to concede defeat in its battle to free the Spirit rover from its Martian sand trap. Doug McQuestion, director of the Mars Exploration Program, said, "Spirit has encountered a golfer's worst nightmare. The sand trap that no matter how many strokes you take, you can't get out of it." However, Spirit will not be abandoned, but used as a stationary scientific platform. The mission team is now concentrating on trying to get the rover tilted in a manner that will maximize the amount of sunlight falling on its solar panels during the approaching winter months, to shorten the period in which Spirit will have to go into hibernation. We have previously reported on the rapid progress of exoskeletons, including prototypes by Panasonic, Cyberdyne, Tokyo University, and Honda. One key challenge for exoskeletons is power autonomy. Current exoskeletons cannot be used for more than a few hours before assistance turns to heavy burden for their users when the batteries run out. In what may announce a major trend shift in the industry, the world's largest defense contractor, U.S. company Lockheed Martin, has now just announced that they will work with Protonix Technology to upgrade their exoskeleton from lithium-ion batteries to fuel cells, boosting autonomy to a full 72 hours. Researchers at the Korea Institute of Science and Technology have developed a new household assistant robot. The Maru Z improves on an earlier prototype moving on wheels and is a humanoid standing about 1.3 meters tall and weighing 55 kilograms. According to a press release, the robot is equipped with stereoscopic vision and can autonomously recognize tasks and execute them. Examples include turning on microwave ovens, washing machines, and toasters, as well as picking up sandwiches or cups. The development of Maru Z is one of Korea's key research projects in the field of cognitive humanoids, with a total yearly budget of around 4 billion won, which is 3.5 million US dollars or 2.5 million euros. For more information on the future of the Spirit Mars rover, the plans for a fuel cell powered exoskeleton, and Korea's Maru Z robot, visit the robots forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Joshua Portlock is the project manager of the CyberQuad project at Cyber Technology out of Perth, Australia. Portlock will be telling us about his company's fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, and their increasingly broad range of applications in the civil market. He'll also be talking in more detail about their CyberQuad, a four-rotor autonomous aircraft that can hover and be used to visually survey oil platforms, bridges, and just about anything else from a close-up aerial position.
Hi, Joshua. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a mechatronic engineering graduate, graduate 05, and focused a lot of my attention towards unmanned aerial vehicles through my degree. In my final year project, built an open quadrotor, and that was quite successful. Then I started my PhD continuing research into multi-rotor hovering unmanned aerial vehicles. specifically focusing on optimization of the platforms and more advanced control systems where there's redundant actuators, fault tolerance, things like that. Then, I continued researching hovering platforms in my spare time when I joined industry and developed the ducted quad rotors and further optimized those. And then brought that to cyber technology, where we've been working together to commercialize it over the last year.
Great. Tell us a little bit about cyber technology then. What kind of company it is, what kind of products you offer.
Sure. Cyber technology is a broad unmanned aerial vehicle system providing company, a complete solution providing, as well as even moving into the services and operations as well. Now, the background is that the managing director had been developing jets for the defense industry for quite a while, behind closed doors somewhat, because it was all confidential projects. But then he built up his capability in fixed wings to move from target drone jets, which are just shot at and usually just disposable drones, to more reusable drones that are for aerial surveillance and reconnaissance. And that brought open it opened a lot of doors into the civil markets as well. So it allowed him to go to more civil applications as well as continuing the defense contracts. And then by bringing the ducted quad rotor platform into the company's portfolio, we now have a very broad portfolio of UAVs ranging from high speed, long endurance, and urban hovering platforms.
Speaking of this quad rotor, because this is what we really want to hear about today, your work on the cyber quad. Tell us a little bit about, maybe in a sentence, what is a quad rotor?
Sure. Quad rotor is a four-propellered helicopter and allows it to hover and fly just like a helicopter without all the mechanical complexity of all the swashplate mechanism and linkages and gears and tail shafts and tail rotors.
Okay. Maybe can you give us a little bit more detail? Why four rotors? Why not three? Why not six, eight, or more? What advantages does that give us over a standard helicopter?
Yep. So the real benefit is that mechanical simplicity. So four is the least number of moving parts or degrees of mobility that you require to get helicopter-type dynamics, where you can fly up, down, turn on the spot left, right, as well as fly omnidirectionally and forward, back, left, and right. So to get those 4 degrees of freedom, you still need 4 degrees of mobility. So at minimum, you're going to need the four fans. If you do go with a two- or three-fan type platform, then you've got extra actuators, linkages, either vanes or collective pitch mechanisms and whatnot in order to get the pitch and roll control, pitch roll yaw control. So four gives you the simplest way of having only moving parts that are rotary fans without having any other devices like vanes and servos and whatnot.
And it seems to me anyway that we're seeing quite an explosion in quad rotors in the last few years, but only really in the last few years. What do you think was the thing that brought quad rotors out into the market and made them so easy now that everybody can build them?
Sure. So the technology enabler for quad rotors is inertial sensors. The angular gyroscopes that measure the angular velocity have becoming more and more affordable and smaller, particularly driven by the consumer world. Accelerometers as well. Best example of that is that the automotive industry started the accelerometers, the idea of sensing crashes and deploying airbags. And then the consumer industry took that on with things like Wii motes and all the mobile phones that have accelerometers now. So those sort of automotive and consumer industries really pushed that technology to get really competitive in price as well as compactness. So those sort of that sort of paid off in the unmanned systems industry, where those sensors are now used to stabilize these craft, and quad rotors require that level of stability to be flown at all. They're not manually flyable. They're just too sensitive in their dynamic, whereas a helicopter has that complicated bell hill stabilizer bar in order to dampen out its dynamics and allow a human to fly it.
Okay, then what is, since we're starting to see them everywhere now that you said these sensors are out, what makes yours different from the competition? What makes yours so special? Maybe tell us a little bit about the CyberQuad before we get started, what it looks like.
Yep, sure. The CyberQuad is a ducted quad rotor, which makes it unique in the sense that it has the shrouds around the fans to protect the fans from exposed contact. The other aspects of the ducts is that I've worked hard on optimizing the ducts to improve static hover efficiency, as well as achieving lift in forward flights when tilted over. So, from a performance point of view, the CyberQuad has a much better lifting capability in a smaller footprint than the other open quad rotors out there on the market.
Wouldn't you say that you add a lot of weight with your duct, though?
Yes and no. The extra lift does pay off the weight penalty, as it carries that extra weight. But more to the point, you've actually got some good structural benefits of having the ducts there in the event of a crash and whatnot. You've got a buffer to bounce off rather than having a sort of flimsy frame and props that are just going to tear themselves apart if they hit something.
Okay, so you're saying it's robust. You can drop it from a building and it would still survive.
Yeah, you can bump into walls and fly through urban environments. We've demonstrated flying it into a suspect building, and it can just bump off the walls and keep flying.
Okay, you also mentioned that you're able to perch with your quad rotor. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, that's an interesting capability that makes it a very long endurance platform. So conventionally, anything that's electric and hovers is going to use a fair bit of power. But we've still worked hard on getting that up into the tens of minutes range. So you can still do a mission in sort of tens of minutes and get over-the-hill reconnaissance of a threat situation or do some inspection around infrastructure. But, pardon me, for a over-the-hill reconnaissance mission that does require more persistence surveillance, we can fly it into that threat situation, land it where the threat or where your observation point is, say a doorway or a window or on a corner of a rooftop, and continue streaming the footage back for many hours compared to the tens of minutes that you can spend in the air. So it allows you to break up your mission into a flight mission or a flight phase and then a perch phase, which can be multiple hours transmitting the video back. And then if something happens or if you're starting to get low on battery, you can fly back with the remaining battery life.
Do you have a special mechanism for perching, or is it really just some legs that you landed on a flat surface?
Yeah, it's basically, we use a fairly clever landing gear structure so that it can land on all sorts of different unstructured environments. One of the biggest issues with a lot of the exposed quad rotors and multi-rotors is if they land on a rough surface or something that's got, objects sticking up, they're likely to hit their propellers and damage them. So with the ducts, at least you can sort of land and bump around, and no matter which way you land, you should still be able to take off again.
Okay. Tell us a bit, maybe a typical mission with the CyberQuad. How does it look? You have some people that show up at a base and fly it around by hand?
Sure. So I wouldn't actually say there is a typical mission, because the vast applications that have been arising have meant that everyone's doing a little bit different, slightly different applications with it. But in a military sense, the type of missions are the over-the-hill reconnaissance and leading a platoon into a threat situation. So they want to look about 500 to a kilometer ahead of them to just see if there's anything on the road that would concern them. Or if there's any hostile situations in the block over or those sort of situations. In a law enforcement application, it's usually a standoff environment where if there's a known threat inside a building or around a building and they're wanting to surround it, but they also don't want to risk people getting too close and fired at or those sort of things, they can fly the quad over the top, look at the rooftop, look at the back entryway, fly down below a gate or whatever it might be blocking them from getting access, and peek in windows and have a better situational awareness of the environment. Then in the civil and industrial applications where they want to inspect infrastructure, there's power poles, for instance, being able to fly up to power poles and look at from the tops and from the oblique angles if the insulators have cracks and any damage or moss and things that might cause pole top fires. That's a big issue in Australia at the moment because of the inspection is hard to inspect all the poles quick enough. So they really need to be inspecting them, otherwise they'll catch fire like they have been and cause bushfires, which can cause a lot more damage than just the local asset alone. In other industries like oil and gas, they have a lot of tall infrastructure that's quite cumbersome to access using rope access, and very expensive to send people up there and risk their lives on these big structures. So again, flying it up to these assets and inspecting valves and pipes and joins that might have concerns. Is a much quicker and lower risk way of doing it with an unmanned vehicle than and particularly the quad, because it can fly close and bump into it and keep flying, than having people up there with rope access.
Now, your cyber quad recently got a lot of media attention for having a look at inspecting a damaged oil rig. Can you tell us a little bit more about that mission?
So we've been doing various applications like that, and the oil rigs are a good example because of being able to fly around the structure that's normally hard to access, particularly if it's a damaged asset that you don't want to send people on until you're sure of the structural integrity. So being able to get right up there and look down at the platform, even fly underneath parts of the platform and look up at it, allows them to evaluate the structural integrity before deciding if people can go on board and do further work, and also make some preliminary decisions on scrapping or repairing subsections.
Let's talk a bit more about intelligence and sensors. What kind of sensors? You keep saying about looking at things. I'm assuming you mount cameras and such. Are there other types of sensors, or what kind of cameras can you mount on the quad rotor?
Sure. So using conventional inertial sensors like gyros, accelerometers, magnetometers, pressure sensors, and GPS, they're the core ones that allow us to do attitude control and position hold. And then with that capability, we can take our hands off and have confidence that the aircraft is going to stay within that GPS position. And we can just point the camera around, tilting the camera up and down and turning the craft left and right to aim the camera at what we want to see. Camera options for the smaller CyberQuad Mini, we have a basic CCD camera, allows you to feel like you're sitting in the pilot seat with the first-person glasses. And that allows the operator to fly up close to infrastructure and get that real-time sensation of what it'd be like if they were up there having a look themselves. And that's good for most applications where it just needs to be a real-time, particularly reconnaissance and law enforcement, where they just need to know what's happening in real-time. But then we have a larger platform, the CyberQuad Maxi, which is more targeted at post-inspection applications where they don't care so much of about seeing it in real-time, but they definitely want the evidence afterwards of the asset, proving, like with high-resolution HD video and high-resolution stills, to show if the asset's damaged or if they do need to repair or maintain a certain asset. So that's the two main platforms we offer at the moment, and it's basically separated into the real-time nature for military law enforcement tend to use the Mini, and the post-process inspection of high-resolution footage is with the Maxi.
How about intelligence? Are they always flown by an operator, or do you have some sort of autonomous movement between GPS points or something?
Sure, we do have a waypoint navigation capability. However, we've found it's not entirely necessary for many applications, where a lot of these applications are very real-time or very in the moment, in the operators and the people interested in the footage are really wanting to have a real-time input into, even if they are post-processing, they want to say, oh, can you look over there? Can you look over there? Can you move that way? So that still tends to be an operator in the loop, even if they are being aided with GPS hold, so that if they get like lost or if they get disoriented, they can flick a switch and it will return home to the takeoff position, and then they can it can auto land, or they can again regain control and continue flying. With the waypoint applications, there are only a few applications that require it, but when they do, we can use a moving map similar to Google Earth to select what waypoints you'd like to go to. Maybe it's an area you're wanting to survey regularly. You'd click the waypoints onto the map, you'd set your altitudes and your speeds between waypoints, your time that you want to be on each target, and also you can aim the camera at different waypoints when you're flying so that it can sort of look around an object and pirouette around it, things like that. So that's for more advanced customers who have repeatable applications where they want to do the same, like perimeter search over and over again, for instance.
Do you think that you will need any more intelligence in the future, any more advanced algorithms, or is this really, in your opinion, all that's necessary in terms of robotic intelligence? I mean, for example, let's imagine in the future having a a quadrotor security guard that regularly goes around, and if it finds something interesting, it goes, checks it out in more detail, for example. Do you see this being an application, or do you really think people will want to spend more time really controlling things in real time?
There's certainly, the world is our oyster, and it's endless possibilities with autonomy. We certainly can see it going that way, and there are some industries and applications where, like you said, the robotic security guard, where it is sitting there waiting ready, and if an alarm goes off, it automatically takes off, flies over, inspects that area. That's definitely an industry that people are interested in, and there's some push towards that. But for now, a lot of the applications are more real-time and still have a pilot in the loop. It's similar to the other unmanned industries where even with the more advanced, sophisticated, larger drones or the ground robots, there still tends to be an operator there making the decisions. I think it's not beyond our capability or beyond some of everyone's capability to make these fully autonomous, flying around, inspecting things and whatnot, but you're still going to have someone making those decisions of, is it necessary to inspect that, and what are the benefits, and then have to at least look at the footage afterwards to decide if it was anything of concern, things like that.
Let's take a bit of a broader look. Many people who look at UAVs and quadrotors, they're a little bit skeptic. They're a bit afraid that they're going to be used right away for spying on people and kind of a big brother society type thing. What do you think about that? Do you think that they will be used maliciously, or that people really shouldn't be worried about it?
Sure, there is a small risk there that the technology can be abused, but we tend to be of the mindset that we obviously abide by the Securities Surveillance Act so that we aren't breaching anyone's privacy, as well as abiding by things like here we have CASA in the US, there's FAA regulations on operating these types of platforms. So as long as people are abiding by those and not breaking the law, basically, as you know, people can break the law in all different ways, then there isn't going to be that issue. There's just as much chance of privacy being invaded by people letting themselves in as there is a UAV flying over. But the way we tend to mitigate that is we make sure that we understand who our customers are and what they're going to be using it for. And we certainly don't want to be encouraging any misuse of our technology. So we're constantly working with our customers to make sure they're aware of the law and that they're abiding the law.
Speaking of the law, as you mentioned, there's the FAA in the US, and I guess you said CASA in Australia. They regulate the air and what can fly in the air. And I guess this whole UAV industry is rather new, so there's probably not so much regulations yet. How do you feel this should be regulated by the government? What should be allowed, what shouldn't be allowed? And maybe tell us what the current state is, for example, in Australia, whether you're allowed to fly whenever you want, or do you always have to log a flight path?
Sure. So those regulations are constantly being updated. They are a bit dated now for the amount of activity that is going on, but there certainly is still some guidelines there that we have to abide by. So for instance, in Australia, we have some clear rules that for these small UAVs that are under sort of 25 kilos, and ideally if they're sort of sub 2 kilos, like the CyberQuad is, that if you operate it below 400 feet or 120 meters, that is, and not within 30 meters of people unrelated to the technology, and you keep it within line of sight, so you're aware of where the vehicle is at all times, then you are allowed to operate these UAVs for various applications. And CASA, as well as FAA, really just want to make sure you're operating it safely. So we have, we've been applying for operator certificates, allowing us to operate them almost like a pilot, like a conventional general aviation pilot, but it's just a different set of rules because you don't have to be as competent as a full-size pilot, but you do have to be aware of the technology and where you are and aren't allowed to use it, and stick to those rules. If you are using it in an environment where you are going to be within 30 meters of people, it's important that you get their permission and that they're considered a part of the operation. If you're taking photos of real estate and those sort of applications, you need to make sure that you've asked permission of the people you're flying over at those sort of things, so that you're not actually risking security breach of security acts and privacy acts.
Maybe let's look at the future. Where do you, in general, see the UAV market in the next few years? I guess it's still a fresh market and a lot of things can happen. Do you think we're going to be moving towards having a lot of little UAVs flying around or of all sizes? Are we going to get bigger, smaller?
Sure. I think it's always going to be a combination. You're always going to be fundamentally limited by the physics in that small UAVs aren't going to fly as long or as far, and large UAVs aren't going to cost as, are going to cost a lot more. So it depends on the industries, but we're certainly seeing there a need for the breadth of variety, in that our larger UAVs that can fly for up to 10 hours have applications in border security and agricultural applications where there's long distances to travel and they want to do it over the course of a whole day and just go back forth across either around a border or across a farm, for instance. And then there are also these applications where people need the rapid response and the compactness and transportability of a quad, of the CyberQuad particularly, that it can fit in a transportable case. You can pull it out and deploy it in less than a minute. You've got an eye in the sky observing the situation. So we're certainly seeing that there's a need for the diversity. And some industries do want it to keep getting smaller and smaller. Like in military and law enforcement, they want to have really compact ones that can fly into tight urban environments. But there's always going to be a limit there. And then the larger ones can go obviously as big as general aviation and bigger, like big predators and whatnot. But the issue there is the cost sensitivity of those larger platforms.
Great, Joshua. Thank you very much for being on Robots Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I was having coffee this morning with some friends. This big discussion came up about how most experts can't define the most important elements in their field. So, of course, someone asked, well, what is a robot? And we got into this big debate where one would say, a robot is this, and then someone else would say, but then my fridge is a robot, or but then a human is a robot. And by the end of the discussion, we had reached a dead end, basically. Therefore, I want to see with you guys if we can figure out a good definition for what a robot is on which we can all agree. So here's how it'll work. Every episode, we'll be asking our friends and audience for their definition of a robot. We'll then be thinking hard to see if there is a counterexample for this definition. If there is, then we will keep going until the next episode. Okay, so here's an example. Adam, what is a robot?
How about a robot is a machine with inputs and outputs?
Yeah, but that would mean that my calculator is a robot, so nope, doesn't work. We need a better definition than that. If you want to tell us what a robot is, email us your short definition at info@robotspodcast.com with your phone number, and we might just call you so that you can give your explanation on the air.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on today's guests, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Hover with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.